Good morning, everybody. Welcome back from a holiday weekend. Hopefully you spent that time really well, making a lot of money, learning a lot of good stuff, or both. All right, the announcement I have is that I did get all the lectures online, and so you can go and look at this semester's or listen to this semester's lectures if you wish. I didn't update the link in Blackboard. Let me show you where that link is yet, but you should all be able to mouse to that website anyway. All right, so I will update the link. Where is it? Lecture recordings, right here. All right, so it's going to springtime, but I'll fix it so that it goes to fall. All those lectures are there. I wanted to point something out because you all are preparing for the lecture exams. And what are you going to use as your number one resource for the lecture exams? Yeah, the study guides. Because when I make up a test, I go to the study guide to know what I should put on the test. Because it's important that I teach you what's in the study guide, and then you should just know what's in the study guide. All right, so if you print out the study guide, so I'm in week one. This is true for all weeks. And here are your practice websites. These are all online questions, and only the questions that I have listed here are the ones that I like. Some of these other questions just take you too far away from information, like number seven. I'm not going to ask you number seven. And so this is different than what's in the study guide. Okay, in the study guide I have, this is the 9th edition of Fox, here's the 13th edition of Fox. I have the 10th, 11th, and 12th edition in your study guide, and I believe those links are gone. They were on a server, and it was built by, not McGraw-Hill, but they paid somebody to do that, and they stopped the contract, and the people erased all those websites. So to replace that information, these are the questions that I like. And I didn't update the study guides. I forgot that I didn't update the study guides. But these questions are going to be very similar to the other ones that I have in your study guide. Okay? All right, so if you're a little bit confused on that, maybe the 12th edition is still available. I'm not sure, but this is the current one. All right, anybody have a question on what you should be studying for the lecture exam coming up? You're pretty good. Print out those study guides, start working with them, and look at those questions and look at them again and look at them again and look at them one more time. Okay. And also that chemistry flash quiz you should probably look at as well, because it shows you the structures of some compounds that you should be really familiar with. So I might put some of that on the test too. Looking at the schedule, today is the 8th, 1 week from today is the 15th, and then 2 weeks from today is the 22nd, and that's the date. Oh, did I say Monday? Tuesday? The 22nd is going to be your first exam. That's 2 weeks from today. Your first exam 2 weeks from today. So you're not running out of time yet, but almost. So get going with that stuff. Anybody have a question on when the test is? And I tell you what do you need for that test? You need a picture ID, indeed you do. A nice clean Scantron, one that isn't all bent up, because when I put a bent up one through the reader, it blocks up the Scantron reader and then nobody gets their grade. So make sure it's a nice unmutilated Scantron and also no stray marks on it. Okay, so Scantron, picture ID, what else? Yeah, pencil. Pretty much any pencil will work, but what's even more important than a pencil? A good eraser that doesn't smudge up your Scantron. All right, so make a mark on a nice white piece of paper with your pencil, erase it with your fancy eraser, and if it doesn't erase it completely, then throw that eraser away so that you never grab it when you're in a hurry to come to take a test. All right, and then you Scantron 882ES. Is the best one to get, and it should be, I've told it's a green color, a greenish background. And one last thing. What is one last thing? The calculator, yes, a basic scientific non-graphing calculator. And your cell phones are much better than that, but you can't use a cell phone during the test. Right? So those have to be turned off. All right, and then that is everything. I might bring a calculator in case you don't have one, but every calculator works a little bit differently. You might not know how to calculate pH using my calculator, unless you come by office hours or something. All right, so that is the schedule. That's something about Blackboard, how you prepare for the exam. So we were talking about osmosis last time and diffusion and solutions and all of that kind of stuff. So I tell you what, let's get started with that. And before I start, does anybody have any questions? Did you write any questions down? Right, while you were studying. Any questions from last time? You're pretty good? All right, so let's proceed with just a little bit of a review. Okay, osmosis, what kind of process is it? Is it active or passive? Passive. It's a passive process, which means something is going to move. How is it going to move? From high concentration to low concentration. Right. Okay, so something is going to diffuse. Right, and it doesn't require energy, but osmosis is special. Give me another special criteria that has to be met in order for it to be osmosis. So it's not just diffusion from high to low. It's something else. What else is it? It has to be the solvent molecule. That's right. Somebody said water, and you're exactly right, because water is the solvent molecule in us. All right, so it has to be only the water molecule, not some kind of solute. Remember, a solution is made up of solute and solvent. Water is the solvent that makes our body. All right, so it's diffusion of water, or the solvent molecule. There's one other special case. Yeah, it has to go through a selectively permeable membrane, or you could say semi-permeable membrane, and, oh, we got them right down over here. I didn't see anybody turn upside down, but here are the answers to osmosis. For future reference, if there is a particle, like this one right here, which is too big to move through the semi-permeable membrane, and water can, we say that this particle right here is osmotically active. Right? Osmotically active. And when we have osmotically active particles, right, then we get to an understanding of tonicity. I'm going to come back to that slide in a second. All right, and we talked about this last time. If we have a normal red blood cell, and the red blood cells are a little bit different compared to most cells because water can diffuse across it pretty easily, across the plasma membrane. There are little channels. And if we put this red blood cell in an isotonic solution, it's not going to change shape because the water concentration on either side of the membrane is the same. But if we put it in a hypertonic solution, it's going to shrivel up. And how would you describe a hypertonic solution? It has more salt on the outside or less salt on the outside compared to the inside? More or less salt on the outside compared to the inside? More solute on the outside compared to the inside, right? That's how it got this name, hyper. And when there's more solute on the outside, then water will diffuse across to try to equalize the concentration of water. So water is going to leave the cell and it's going to lose volume and shrivel up. Oh, here, water is leaving. If we put it in a hypotonic solution, could you give me an example of a hypotonic solution? Water right out of this faucet here would be hypotonic. Okay, very little solute in it. Distilled water is a hypotonic solution. So it doesn't have any solutes, and no particles, it's pure water. So if it's 100% water outside the cell and a little bit less inside, water will diffuse in and the volume of the cell is going to expand and very rapidly, and in most cases it expands so much that the cell is going to burst. All right, so what do we call it when the cell bursts? Hemolysis, that's right. What do we call it when the cell shrivels up? Crenation. So you got to remember, crenation is produced by a hypertonic solution. Hemolysis is produced by a hypotonic solution. And of course, when we transfuse patients, what kind of solution should we inject into them? Isotonic, that's right, because we don't want to do anything nasty to their red blood cells. Which process is irreversible, crenation or hemolysis? Hemolysis, right? Once you blow a cell up, you can't get back. But this cell, right, this crenated cell doesn't blow up, so it can go back to its normal volume. So here we have that crenated cell. How do we get it back to its normal size? Just put it in an isotonic solution, and then it will balance out properly, right? Okay. All right, so what about regulation of blood osmolality? Oh, I got to go back to this slide right here. Okay, the difference between molarity and molality. We want to take 1 mole of glucose. All right, so is that what we're dealing with here? Looks like 1 mole of glucose here has got 180 grams. For some reason, I know that that's glucose. That's 1 mole of glucose. How would you come up with this 180 number right here? Okay, yeah, that is the molecular weight. And how would you come up with that molecular weight of any kind of compound? You got to know the molecular formula. You have to know the number of carbons, the number of hydrogens, the number of oxygens, and then use your periodic table to find out what the atomic weight of oxygen is. Multiply times the number that are in that molecule. It's 6 in this particular case. Then you got to add, okay, carbon to it. Look in the periodic table, find out the atomic weight of carbon, multiply that by 6, add it to it, and the same thing for the hydrogens, and you come up with 180 grams. All right, and, oh, here it is right here. So that's 1 mole of glucose, 180 grams, and a mole is just number of particles, here, and it's a really big number. If we had 1 mole of people, we probably couldn't fit it on the planet. All right, I don't know if that's for sure. I have to ask some of my physics people to do that calculation, but shoulder to shoulder, we probably wouldn't even fit because that's such a huge number. These molecules are what? Very, very small. So if we put 1 mole of glucose or 180 grams into this beaker and then add water to fill it to exactly 1 liter mark right here, that's a molar solution. That's how we would calculate molarity, and that's always designated with a capital M. And so depending on the solute that you put into this beaker, you have to add more or less water to it. All right? So if it's a really big molecule, right, then you have to add less water. If it's a really small solute particle, then you have to add more water. So there's some variability when we calculate a solution in terms of its molarity. Maybe a better way to do this is to take 1 mole of the solute, and that's what, 180 grams, put it in the beaker, and then take exactly 1 liter of solution, 1 liter of water, and put it into the beaker. So now we have the volume of glucose plus 1 liter, which is the volume of water, added into the beaker. So now the overall volume is greater than 1 liter. This is what we call molality. And so it's a little bit different. So the molar solution doesn't specify the exact amount of water, but the molal solution does. Right? It gives you the exact amount of water. And how much water, one molal solution, how much water is in that? Yeah, it's going to be 1 liter, and it just so happens at the proper temperature and pressure, right? 1 liter is equal to 1 kilogram. These things are equal to each other, and that's how people came up with the standard of how things weigh, just by looking at water. All right, so let's get back to this slide right here. Osmolality. So it's a way that your body looks at the concentration of something. All right, so the osmolality is maintained within a normal range, right, for homeostasis. To maintain homeostasis, about 300 milliosmolar. If dehydration occurs, right, then this number increases. Right? And so how is the proper osmolality maintained? So how do you think your body maintains the proper osmolality in your body? What would be one way to think about that? It's going to be some kind of control mechanism. Okay, so there has to be a sensor. Yeah, there's got to be a receptor for that. Okay, and it is in the hypothalamus. What else do you need? Yeah, you got to have a response, right? And so what happens between the receptor? Oh, what does the receptor measure in this particular case? Osmolality, right? All right, so that's the receptor, and it produces a response. How does that happen? Response loop or feedback loop. Remember all the different components of a feedback loop? So you have the receptor, which is sensitive to some kind of stimulus, which is going to be a change in the saltiness of solution, which we call milliosmolality. And then it sends that information into the central nervous system via what kind of pathway? afferent pathway, gets into the central nervous system. All right, big deal. What's in the central nervous system? There's a set point, right? And then that, where's the center, what's that center called that has a set point? The integration center. So it's going to add a couple things together, like what the set point to what the stimulus is. And if the stimulus is exactly equal to the set point, what's the decision the integration center is going to make? No change. Everything's perfect. But if there's a difference, if there's an error, then the integration center makes a decision on what to do and sends that decision to the rest of the body via what kind of pathway? An efferent pathway to an effector, which produces a response, right? So we want to think of that feedback or that response loop when we look at this diagram right here. And what would you guess, what's the relationship between the response and the stimulus? Do you think they should add together or subtract from each other? Yeah, if homeostasis is being maintained, they should subtract from each other. And so that feedback loop is going to be called a negative feedback loop, right? Okay, so when somebody becomes dehydrated, blood volume goes down because we're losing solvents from our body. Blood volume goes down. Plasma osmolality increases. That means your plasma gets more salty because those particles still remain in your body. You're only losing water. And so there are osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus that can tell that you're becoming dehydrated. And so there is an error. It's not, the osmolality is not at the set point. So the hypothalamus makes a decision, sends that decision out some efferent pathways. And one pathway is really short because the center for thirst is in the hypothalamus as well. So the hypothalamus triggers your thirst center. You have a conscious feeling that you're thirsty. And when you're thirsty, typically you drink something and hopefully, you know, it's not a hypertonic solution because that wouldn't help you, but a hypotonic solution would, right? The hypothalamus also, right, adjusts the ADH secretion. And you should know where the hormone ADH is released from. It is the pituitary, and probably even know what part of the pituitary, and it is the posterior pituitary. So to help you see that, how many hormones does the posterior pituitary secrete? That might help a little visual learning. I see two, all right, ADH and oxytocin. Only two from the posterior pituitary. Maybe you want to look at your anatomy book. And ADH stands for antidiuretic hormone. So what does a diuretic do? Makes you pee, makes you lose water, all right, but that was what the initial stimulus was. Antidiuretic hormone makes you conserve water, makes you maintain water, right? It decreases the amount of water that's lost in urine, right? It produces a very small amount of urine that's highly concentrated, and ADH then goes to the kidneys. How does it get to the kidneys? ADH is a hormone, so ADH from the posterior pituitary enters the circulation through a blood vessel, goes to the kidneys, and tell me the name of that blood vessel that ADH, that allows ADH to enter the blood in the posterior pituitary. Name that particular kind of blood vessel. Okay, so I saw somebody say it, but I didn't hear it, so you could say it out loud. It is a capillary, right? Because what's the special function of a capillary, just in one word? It is exchange. Yeah, things can enter and leave the circulation only through a capillary. Right, so then ADH gets to the kidneys and it enters the kidneys and it can change the response of the kidneys. So there's got to be another kind of blood vessel in the kidney. And what? So how does ADH get out of the circulation into the kidneys then? What kind of blood vessel? It's got to be a capillary for exchange, right? So then you have ADH in that interstitial fluid, and it can bump into cells of the kidney. And it's going to then conserve water, right? It's going to resorb water from filtrate, and so that's what we call water retention. So if we increase the amount of water that we're retaining in our body, plus we add more water because we're drinking, what is that compared to the initial stimulus, which is dehydration, right? They subtract from each other, so this is a nice negative feedback loop. And we know that negative feedback loops maintain homeostasis, right? So in terms of the homeostatic mechanisms for maintaining the saltiness of blood or the osmolality of blood, you should be aware of what ADH from the posterior pituitary, and also the triggering of the thirst center as well. And that forms a nice negative feedback loop. So maybe go back and look at that exam, the extra credit drawing that you did in lab, right? So try to just fit everything into that diagram, and that will be really nice. All right, so that's it for that first topic. Now we're going to get back to a membrane and talk about things that how things get across a membrane. So tell me a little bit about a membrane first before we get started. It's a phospholipid bilayer, and it means that what's the inside of that membrane like? It's nonpolar, or you could say hydrophobic, right? All of those fatty acid tails are sticking toward the interior of the membrane. They're held together by those. Oh, what is holding all those tails of a phospholipid together in the interior of a membrane? What kind of bond is that? So you know covalent, you know ionic, you know hydrogen, and what's the fourth one? Van der Waals. So here's a hint. It's got to be one of those four. Van der Waals forces, right? Because that's an interaction between hydrophobic groups, so the membrane is stabilized by that. So what kind of compounds can move through the phospholipid bilayer as a result of that? Only nonpolar or hydrophobic molecule. So there are a lot of ions that are polar or hydrophilic. They cannot diffuse across the membrane, so something special has to happen. Right? They usually require a carrier or a channel. Molecules too large or polar to diffuse, right? If something's polar, it's hydrophilic, can't get through the hydrophobic region of the cell membrane, right? To diffuse, are transported across the membrane by protein carriers, right? So you have a membrane and your cell adds a bunch of proteins to it, so you should have a little bit more sophisticated concept of a membrane. It's not just a phospholipid bilayer. What's another way that we can talk about a membrane? And we haven't done it in this class yet. A good model in your mind, which we did talk about at anatomy, is the fluid mosaic model. So the fluid part is the phospholipid bilayer. The mosaic part of that model means that other things can be added to that phospholipid bilayer, like a protein for transport, right? Carrier-mediated transport. So something special has to happen. Molecules have to have an association with that protein. Molecules must bind to that membrane protein carrier first before it's transported. Okay, so let's look and see what can be happening here. What are some characteristics of carrier-mediated transport? I see a nice graph. All right, and so on the horizontal, we see the concentration of some kind of particle that is going to be transported across the membrane. It also means that X cannot go across the membrane by itself. So tell me something about the physical chemistry of this particle that we call X. It is polar. I heard polar. I like polar. And so it is hydrophilic, right? If it's hydrophilic, can't get through the membrane by itself because of that hydrophobic region on the inside of the membrane. So if we look at plot the concentration of this hydrophilic compound versus the rate of transport, right, we're going to see as the concentration increases, as we have more particles per volume of solution, what happens to the rate of transport? Let's look at the solid line. Right. It increases, right? It increases. If we increase the concentration, the rate of transport increases. I think that kind of makes sense. Right? But if we increase the rate of, increase the concentration further, it starts to level off. And then we get to a point that even if we increase the concentration, remember this is increasing concentration along the horizontal axis, right? Then there is no further increase in the rate of transport. And so this leveling off is what we call saturation. All those proteins, right, are bound to a molecule X, And if it's bound to molecule X, the one that's next to it in solution can't bind, and if it can't bind, then it can't be transported. So all of the protein carriers are bound at this point, so even if we add more X to solution, no more can get across the membrane. And here we have the transport maximum, and so membrane carrier-mediated transporters exhibit the property of saturation. And what's not shown on this particular slide is that this X molecule has to bind to the protein carrier. And there's a way that we think about binding. Why is it that some molecules can bind together? We looked at charge, right? What kind of charges attract each other? Opposite, right? Positive will attract the negative, right? But let's not think about charge. What's another way that molecules can associate with each other? Okay, with the receptor. And what can you tell me? So the receptor is that protein inside the cell membrane. There's something special about that receptor in relationship to the thing that's going to bind to it for transport. In this case, it's going to be X. What's the relationship between that receptor and X? And I said you could use charge, but let's pretend there's no difference in charge. Okay, so charge is not going to allow these things to come together. What's going to allow association of receptor and that little particle that's going to bind to it? That little particle, I want to use another little definition. That little particle that binds to a receptor is called a ligand. A ligand is just some small little particle binding to a receptor. So how do we understand binding of ligand to receptor? Is a really good question. Okay. How does your hand fit into a glove? By shape, right? And so that's why, again, anatomy is so important, because the shape of the molecules will determine whether a ligand can bind to a receptor or not. It's by shape. And so that's what we mean by specificity. Only the specially shaped molecules can bind to a receptor or a carrier or even an enzyme. Specificity. So in this particular case, if X is a sugar molecule, okay, and it's surrounded by other kinds of molecules, maybe like proteins, can a protein bind to that carrier molecule? No, because it's going to have a different shape, right? That carrier is specific for the shape of the whatever X is. All right. Another concept is competition. If you have X that has a particular shape and another molecule, Y, which has a very similar shape, right, then Y can bind to the receptor, and if Y binds to that receptor or the carrier molecule, then it excludes the X molecule. So the rate of rate of transport of X is decreased when you have a competitor in solution. Right, because some of the transporters are occupied by Y, and that means that X can't get on that receptor to be transported across the membrane. So specificity is shape. Competition, if you have a couple of the same shape molecules or very similar, right, then the rate of the first molecule of transport is going to decrease. And then saturation happens in either case because there are just so many transporters in the membrane. And when they are bound to the molecule that's being transported, they can't transport another one. Okay. So be a little bit familiar with specificity, competition, and saturation. Facilitated diffusion. We're going to look at this first mechanism right here. Facilitated diffusion, is this an active process or a passive process? Okay, I heard both. All right, so let's just think about plain old simple diffusion. Is plain old simple diffusion active or passive? It's passive, which means molecules have to go. This is just a review from earlier today. Molecules go from high concentration to low concentration if it's diffusion. Facilitated diffusion is a special case of diffusion, which means molecules still can only go from high concentration to low. And does it require energy? It does not. It's a passive process. All right, but why do we put facilitated right here? Let's look at the cell membrane. Right, we've got a super magnifying microscope. We can see the individual molecule. So what is the simplest way to describe a membrane that I'm circling right here? Phospholipid bilayer, right? You see the bilayer of the phospholipids, and the inside of the membrane right here, the interior of the membrane is what, hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's hydrophobic, right? So hydrophilic compounds can't get across the membrane because they're excluded by the interior of a membrane. And now let's look at a solute particle. And here is the outside of the cell, here's the inside. Where is the solute particle at a higher concentration? We see it outside the cell clearly, low concentration on the inside. So with this solute, and it just so happens that this is a glucose molecule, and glucose dissolves in water very easily because of all those polar covalent bonds, because all those oxygen atoms that are on glucose. All right, so glucose dissolves in water, and if it dissolves in water, can it get through the membrane by itself? It cannot because of that hydrophobic area on the interior of the membrane. All right, but you also told me glucose is dying to get into the cell. It can if there is a special protein embedded in the membrane. All right, so I see the phospholipid bilayer, but now we've added a protein to it. What's a good way to describe the membrane now with this protein embedded in the membrane? The fluid, right? Phospholipid bilayer is fluid. This protein is the mosaic part of that model in our mind, so we would use the fluid mosaic model to describe this membrane in this particular location. Okay. So here is a protein embedded in the membrane. It goes all the way across the membrane. And in this particular case, I see that it has an opening to the outside of the cell. And that opening is not to the inside. It's only to one side of the membrane. So glucose can enter this area. And there just so happens to be a site on this protein that matches up in shape perfectly so a glucose molecule can fit into this area. This is what we call the active site. Right? And when glucose binds, look what happens to this protein. Right? It kind of acts like a teeter-totter, and it closes off to the outside of the cell, and then a pathway to the inside of the cell opens up, and then glucose is released from the binding site, okay, to the interior of the cell. And so we see glucose going from high concentration to low, and indeed it is diffusion, and no energy is required. Just the binding of the molecule to this protein is enough to get it to activate the way that it should. And so glucose goes down its concentration gradient, which is diffusion. It's facilitated because it needs this protein in the membrane in order for that to happen. Okay, so what would happen to a cell if it didn't have these proteins in the membrane and there was high glucose on the outside? What would happen to the cell? Could glucose get in? It couldn't get in, right? Because glucose is hydrophilic, hydrophobic membrane. So glucose is trapped outside the cell. And does anybody know a particular condition where a person's glucose is high outside of cells and low inside and glucose can't get in? Diabetes mellitus would be a good example of that, right? So transporters like this, we realize, are not operating. There's one explanation for diabetes mellitus. All right, so we're going to take a look at that in a number of different ways during this class. All right, so we have facilitated diffusion. Nice. Okay. All right, well, one way that a cell can regulate, or the body can regulate, how much glucose enters the cell so the cell doesn't starve to death. Glucose is an important energy molecule. And cells do starve to death when somebody has diabetes mellitus. I should say uncontrolled diabetes mellitus. What organs are especially sensitive when somebody has uncontrolled diabetes mellitus? These cells starve to death and these organs actually die. What organs are really sensitive to that? Okay, yeah, brain for sure. It's not the first one that you maybe notice because we don't really know how to measure dementia quite fast enough. But the brain, diabetes mellitus might contribute to like clinical depression and other things like that. But some organs that die pretty rapidly would be the retina. Where's the retina located? Yeah, they're the photoreceptors in somebody's eyes. So somebody with uncontrolled diabetes has a tendency to go blind as a result of that. And kidneys are affected as well. Very highly metabolic organs in your body, kidneys and retina. All right, so if normal regulation is taking place, here we have a vesicle inside the cell, right? So here's inside the cell, here's outside the cell. And look at all of these glucose transporters. They're embedded in the membrane of this vesicle. And can these carrier proteins, when they're embedded in the membrane of the vesicle, can they allow the cell to take up glucose by facilitated diffusion? They can't because they're not in the cell membrane. In order for them to operate, they have to be placed in the cell membrane, and a really easy way of doing that is just move over this vesicle with the carrier proteins to the cell membrane, and then these two things fuse together, and now look what you have. You have a whole bunch of transporters now inserted into the membrane, and glucose can go through each one of these. This vesicle with all these transporters, so these transporters are reserved for these facilitated diffusion, we call that an endosome. An endosome is a special vesicle inside the cell, not because of what it has on the inside, but because what it has in the membrane of the vesicle, and when it moves over to the cell membrane, whatever in the membrane of the vesicle then adds to the membrane of the cell, and in this particular case, a pathway for glucose uptake. This is pretty handy, because here we have one vesicle, and I see six transporters. A vesicle might have thousands and thousands of transporters in there, right? And if the cell was allowed to take up glucose and it had to build each one of these thousands of transporters, right, it could take a long time, maybe a day, maybe a week, right? And so if these transporters are built and put in a reserve section like an endosome, when it gets the proper signal, all of these transporters all at once can be put into the cell membrane, not quite instantaneously, but rapidly. You don't have a body, or these cells don't have to wait around for weeks and weeks and weeks to build all of these proteins. All right, so that's a really handy mechanism. There is a signal. Maybe some of you could figure out, maybe we talked about it a little bit, there is a signal that tells this vesicle to move over to the cell membrane so that the cell can take up glucose. Okay, there is a signal. When glucose is high in the extracellular space, the signal is generated in your body, right? And that signal then tells this cell to move all of these glucose transporters over to the cell membrane so that glucose can leave, for instance, like the blood and get into the cell. You know, and when it leaves the blood and gets into the cell, what happens to the concentration of glucose in the blood? When it leaves the blood, goes into the cell, blood glucose concentration goes down. Do you know a hormone that causes a decrease in blood glucose? And that would be insulin, right? So here is one way to think about how insulin works in somebody. It puts all of these glucose transporters in the cell membrane. So glucose is like a passport that allows, insulin is like a passport that allows glucose to enter the cell because it puts all of these proteins, right, in the plasma membrane. Okay, another kind of, so that was passive transport. Here is an example of active transport. And let's look at an ion called calcium. Can anybody tell me what kind of ion calcium is? I see it right here. Calcium is what kind? Is it an ion? Do you believe me? Is it an ion? I heard no. I want to hear yes. Okay, why is this an ion? Because I see a electrical charge on it, right? An ion has an electrical charge. And how many electrical charges does it have? Two. All right, so what kind of ion is this? It's a cation. And then you also, and if you're going to tell me what kind of ion it is, you also have to tell me the valence. It's a cation, but what kind of cation is it? Yeah, it's a two-something. We say bivalent cation, remember that? Bivalent or divalent cation because it has a positive 2. What about potassium if it had just 1 plus? Potassium 1 plus would be a monovalent cation, right? So that's a little bit of a review. All right, so here we see a nice phospholipid bilayer. Here is a special kind of protein. And notice that it is closed to the outside of the cell. It's open to the inside in this particular case. And again, this protein can be open only to one side of the membrane or the other, one at a time, not both. Can't be open to both sides of the membrane, just the way that it's built. And one thing that you should remember is that calcium is low inside the cell. It's almost zero, right? So just remember, low inside the cell, and where is calcium high? Outside the cell. So in our bodies, calcium is high outside the cell, low inside. Now, we want to move calcium to keep the inside of the cell very low. We want to take this calcium and boot it out of the cell, make it go from low to high. What kind of process is that when something goes from low concentration to high concentration? Think of my car. It's an active transport mechanism, right? Things can only go from high to low passively. All right, so here we have some calcium inside the cell. It can bind, it can enter this protein, it can bind to this protein. That is not enough energy. The binding of calcium to this protein is not enough to get it to change conformation so that it's open to the outside. There is another binding site on this particular illustration. It's right here. It's a binding site for ATP. What do you know about ATP? Energy, that's right. They're chemical bonds that have high energy. So when ATP binds to this site right here, ATP is hydrolyzed. There's a hydrolysis reaction. So what happens to that molecule of ATP with a hydrolysis reaction? Does it get bigger or smaller? Yeah, it gets broken down, right? That's a hydrolysis reaction. It gets broken down into ADP. There are two phosphates. ATP has three, so there's one inorganic phosphate left over. And there was a chemical bond in ATP. It is now broken. And what is contained in that chemical bond? That is broken. There is energy in that chemical bond in ATP. When you break it, that energy is released, and that energy is used to change the conformation of this protein in the membrane. So now it opens up to the outside of the cell, but now it's closed to the inside, and calcium then, right, can move out of the protein into this area where there is high calcium. All right, so this is what we call active transport. Requires energy in the form of this particular case, in the form of ATP, right? So ATP is being used up. So indeed, in our bodies, right, things can move from low concentration to high concentration, but some kind of energy is going to be required. A lot of times when you look at an illustration, if you see ATP, right, associated with some kind of transport mechanism, you will know automatically that it is, two choices, active or passive. It's an active transport process. And in particular, one last little complicating thing, if ATP, not only is it active transport, we call that primary active transport. So anytime you see an ATP, you want to say primary active transport. Right, so ATP is the energy source. This thing right here. All right, let's stay on this slide for a second. This thing, this protein in the membrane that can move calcium from low to high, is what we call a pump. Right, and a pump, just think of a pump. Maybe you needed some water and you have water way down in the ground. To get that water up, you have to pump it up. And that requires energy to do that. Same thing for this protein. All right, so some active transport process that requires ATP to move something from low to high is generally what we call a pump in this particular class. All right, here is another example. Does this look like an active transport or passive transport mechanism when you look at this slide? Active, why? What shows you that right away? The ATP on the slide. All right, and what kind of active transport is that going to be? That's going to be primary active transport. We haven't talked about any other kind, so it's maybe kind of hard to remember that, but ATP is primary active transport. All right, so let's take a look at this. We're looking at two ions, potassium and sodium. Right, inside your bodies, around living cells, We should have sodium at a high concentration on the outside, low on the inside. And we should have high potassium on the inside and low on the outside. There's like an opposition of concentrations right here. So that you should become really familiar with. Right? Where is potassium going to be a high concentration? Inside the cell, right? And where is sodium at high concentration? On the outside of the cell. If potassium ever gets to be a high concentration on the outside of the cell, that could be the death of the cell. All right, so that's why potassium, this little salt right here, is so important to control when you have a patient in the hospital, because sometimes their potassium is really low and a doctor will write an order to give a patient potassium, and somebody comes with potassium, gives it to that patient, and maybe they didn't write a note on their chart, right? And another person reads that and says, oh, this person needs potassium, so they get some more potassium, hang it, give that to the patient. And the patient will die as a result of that, right? So potassium is really important. Where should it be high? Not in the blood or outside the cell. Potassium should be high inside the cell, and the opposite for sodium. All right, so here's a protein, and this protein can take potassium from low concentration on the outside and pump it to the inside, right, going from low to high. What kind of transport is that when something goes from low to high? Active transport. Here's the ATP, so that's primary active transport. What about sodium? It goes from inside to outside, and again, from low concentration to high concentration. That also is active transport, right? And here is the energy for that, okay, that ATP. So there's a binding site for potassium, a binding site for sodium, binding site for ATP. That chemical bond contains energy. When it's hydrolyzed, it allows the conformation of this protein so that potassium and sodium can be pumped. Interesting thing about this sodium-potassium pump is that the number of potassiums and sodiums that get pumped for every ATP is different. It just so happens that two potassiums get pumped in and three sodiums get pumped out. All right, so if you have two positive charges, I tell you what, let's think of another pump. If two positive charges enter while two positive charges leaves, what happens to the charge across the membrane if two leave and two enter? It's the same, all right? But what happens if two positive charges enter but three positive charges leave? What happens to the inside of the cell? It becomes more negative as a result of that, okay? All right, so the sodium-potassium pump is pretty important because it helps maintain that electrical difference across the cell membrane. And it just makes the inside of the cell more negative because it pumps more positives out than positives in. All right, so three sodiums to two potassiums, and you see that it is primary active transport. Most of the energy in your body that we consume every day in our diet is used to make ATP that runs this pump right here. All right, so this pump right here really explains your life. So this is a pretty important slide, a very interesting slide. How much ATP do you need every day? Does anybody have a sense of how much ATP that you need? And most of it goes to run this pump right here? A lot, right? So what is some way to think about that? Organelle that makes ATP in your body is a mitochondria. You might remember that from anatomy. Mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP, right? If we cut off oxygen to the brain, like when somebody's heart stops beating, no oxygen can get to the brain, then mitochondria can't make ATP, but these pumps are still using it up. If mitochondria can't make it and these pumps use it up, then your brain is going to run out of ATP. One way to measure brain function is by just knowing if somebody's conscious or unconscious, right? If somebody's unconscious, the energy state of their brain could be really low, or ATP could be really low. So when somebody's heart stops, they lose consciousness, how long does it take? How much ATP is in the brain to maintain consciousness in terms of time? How long can they maintain consciousness when somebody's heart stops? Okay? It is 2 to 3 seconds, really short period of time. right? Because these pumps stop working, right? And that electrical charge across the membrane isn't maintained properly, and somebody loses consciousness as a result, right? If you can get blood supply back to the brain, they can come back to life, maybe with deficits, maybe not. But if blood supply isn't returned to the brain is eventually going to die because it uses up all of the ATP, right? None of these pumps can work. The brain dies. And when the brain dies, can it ever come back to life? No. When something's dead, it's dead. Can't come back to life. All right. So if we stop blood delivery to the brain, 2 to 3 seconds, somebody becomes unconscious. But when does the person's brain actually die? Because all the ATP is used up. It's 2 to 3 minutes, right? 2 to 3 minutes. So that's how much ATP the brain uses, all right? A lot. And many organs are the same way. Another way to think of ATP is to think in terms of your body weight. And I don't know if anybody's measured themselves on a scale that measures kilograms, right? We usually do it in pounds around here, but kilograms, right? A typical textbook person weighs 70 kilograms. Does that ring a bell to anybody that works in kilograms? More or less. Okay, like a textbook kind of case. 70 kilograms. So how much ATP in terms of a person's body weight do they have to have every day to stay alive? Because it's going to be hydrolyzed, right? It's going to be broken down. Then you need another ATP. How much ATP do you need to stay alive every day in terms of your body weight? What's your body weight again? 70 kilograms. And the answer is 40 kilograms. More than half your body weight of ATP is burned up every day, is hydrolyzed. Right, so that's how important ATP is. Most of it is used, right, to run this sodium-potassium pump everywhere in your body. Okay, there's another kind of active transport mechanism. Right, and it's called secondary active transport. So let's take a look at a molecule that is going to be used, and it is Na+. What's Na+? Sodium, right? Okay, and sodium can move from low concentration to high concentration. Do you know of a way that sodium could go from low concentration to high concentration? Sodium-potassium pump going from low to high concentration, so high concentration outside the cell. Right, so that's what this figure represents. Right, sodium is moving from low concentration to high concentration, like when it's kicked out of the cell by primary active transport. I don't see an ATP. Right, I can't draw it in, right, but I at least typed it in here. It requires energy in the form of ATP. Right, so when sodium goes from low to high, requiring ATP, what kind of transport mechanism is that? That's active transport. Okay, so now we have high sodium outside the cell. Let's go back to this previous slide. So now we have sodium high outside the cell, low inside. So where is this sodium dying to go? Where does it want to go? Just passively. Back inside the cell, right? It wants to go back inside the cell, but can it go back inside the cell? It can't because of the hydrophobic nature of this membrane. So now you have high concentration sodium outside. It's dying to get back in, but it can't. But if your body adds a special protein that allows sodium to enter the cell, that's where we get to the second part of this illustration. Sodium can re-enter the cell, and that's passive, right, going from high concentration to low. And here is a special protein in the membrane, and I see it as a teeter-totter. And that energy of sodium going from high to low can make glucose go from low to high. What is that process when something goes from low concentration to high concentration? Active transport, right? And do you see an ATP molecule here? Okay, so it is active transport, but not primary. This is what we call secondary active transport. So what is being used for this kind of active transport? It is the gradient of sodium going from high to low, right? It's used to drive glucose from low to high, right? That's the energy that's being used And so the requires energy in the form of a chemical gradient. A chemical gradient is used. And that's what we call secondary active transport. Okay, I'm sure you're going to have to look at this slide a couple of times. So these two transport mechanisms, sodium going from low to high, and glucose going from low to high. Sodium going from high to low, right? Sodium going from high to low, while glucose goes from low to high. This is coupled together, right? This is coupled together. Okay. Different ways that we can think of secondary active transport. Right? Well, for sure, in any case, there has to be a difference in concentration of some molecule, and your body uses sodium a lot because of that sodium-potassium ATP pump that's working all the time. If you have two molecules that move across the membrane in the same direction, so here we have sodium and glucose, right, entering the cell. Okay, if these two molecules go in the same direction, right, we call that symport or co-transport. Right? This is secondary active transport. We know this is secondary active transport because why? I don't see any ATP. All right, so sodium, where's sodium at a high concentration? Normal conditions, it is high outside the cell or inside the cell? It's high inside the cell. No, it's high outside the cell, low inside, so sodium wants to go down its concentration gradient. Glucose usually is high outside, okay, and could be low inside. Then the energy in this gradient will then import glucose, even though glucose could be at a higher concentration inside the cell compared to the outside. So glucose can go from low to high as long as sodium goes from high to low. If these two molecules move in the same direction, like what I see over here at the end, we call that a co-transport mechanism. A transporter doesn't always have to work that way. It can use what we call an antiport or a counter-transport mechanism, where the two molecules that are involved go in opposite directions. So an example of a counter-transport mechanism would be when glucose goes from outside to inside, while sodium goes from inside to outside. They go in opposite directions. That's what we call a counter-transport, and that would still be secondary active transport because no ATP is being used. All right, let's look at a nice real-world circumstance, situation. All right, transport across epithelial membranes. All right, so I'm looking at an epithelium right here. What kind of epithelium am I looking at? Okay. These things right here kind of look like cilia, but these are actually microvilli. Okay, microvilli increase the surface area, the length of the cell. Right, that's its job. So it's not for motility. It just increases the surface area of the cell. But, okay, so that's one. That's nice that you see that. But what kind of tissue is this? Okay, it is an epithelium because it's covering some kind of surface, like the surface right here or the blood. And how many cells do we see from here to here? One. So that's what we call a simple epithelium, right? This is the basement, the basal part of the cell. Here is the apical part of the cell, right? So do you see that the proteins in the apical surface are different than the basal surface? Apical surface, I see this protein. Basal surface, I see these two over here, right? So the apical surface can have different shaped chemicals placed in the membrane, which means that the apical membrane can have a different kind of what compared to the basal surface? Different kind of function. That's right. So these proteins give some kind of function to the membrane. If they're different in different locations, then the function of these membranes is going to change. All right, so what do we have on this apical surface? Here we have a protein, okay, and it's going to allow glucose entry into the cell. And it just so happens that in this kidney tubule, right, you have low glucose concentration, relatively high inside. So if glucose goes from low to high, what kind of transport is that? Active or passive? Glucose going from low to high is active. Do you see any ATP being used right here? Do you see ATP on this illustration? You could go ahead and tell me. You're not going to be wrong because I don't see any. There's no ATP. So could this be primary active transport? It cannot. All right. But since it is active transport, it needs some kind of energy in order to make glucose go from low to high. Where is it getting the energy? The gradient concentration of sodium. So it's high on the outside, low on the inside. Sodium is dying to get into the cell. So there's energy in that gradient. So both sodium and glucose bind to this transporter. They both enter the cell at the same time. The concentration gradient goes down, but glucose enters the cell. Glucose goes from low to high. When we have two molecules going in the same direction due to active transport, what kind of mechanism do we call that? That's co-transport or symport, right? So glucose enters the cell. So here is that special kind of transporter. This is the lumen of a kidney tubule. What, can you tell me something about the lumen? What's the lumen of something? It's the inside of a tube. This particular tube is like, could anybody give me a specific name of this kind of kidney tubule? What kind of kidney tubules are you aware of? Proximal convoluted tubule, maybe, heard of that? Distal convoluted tubule, what about loop of Henle? All those tubules inside the kidney, okay. Name that fluid that's inside the proximal convoluted tubule and distal convoluted tubule. What's the name of that fluid? It's called filtrate. I got to work up a lecture for you guys to remember that before class, right? So inside kidney tubules, you have filtrate. And a lot of good things can get filtered through the glomerulus into the filtrate, including glucose. Right? So glucose enters the filtrate, and where does that filtrate end up? I mean, if it's in the filtrate, and eventually where does it end up? It becomes urine, and where does urine end up? Outside your body, right? So anything that's in filtrate, if it stays in the filtrate, is excreted from your body. Here we have glucose. Do you think glucose is an important molecule inside your body, or is it okay for you to pee it away? It's important, right? So all the glucose in filtrate should be moved out of the filtrate back into your body, right? Because, and in a normal circumstance, all of us have enough of these proteins right here, these glucose transporters, to get glucose out of the filtrate from low concentration to high. A normal person will have zero concentration of glucose in filtrate. Somebody with diabetes mellitus will have glucose, too high a glucose concentration, because all of these transporters are saturated. So some glucose gets left in the filtrate and they pee it out of their body, right? Okay, so that would be a nice sign of diabetes mellitus, glucose in urine. So glucose can go from low to high with this co-transport mechanism as long as sodium can go from high to low, that gradient. All right, so we have sodium low inside the cell. And we have glucose high inside the cell. How is this maintained? How is sodium maintained at a low concentration inside the cell? Here is that sodium-potassium pump, which does what? Takes sodium from low to high, okay, but then also potassium has to go from high to low, okay? So here is the pump that allows that to happen. And what kind of active transport is that? Primary active transport, because we see ATP being used. All right, so sodium goes from low to high, potassium goes from low to high. That's both active transport, and ATP means that it is primary active transport. One last thing we have to look at. We have glucose inside the cell, inside this epithelium, but we actually want it inside our bodies. Right? How does it actually enter the circulatory system, the blood? Well, we have high glucose inside the cell, low in the blood. Which way does glucose want to go? Down the concentration gradient from high to low. But can glucose move across the cell membrane? No, because it is hydrophilic. The membrane is hydrophobic. How do you know that glucose can get across the membrane? Through what kind of process? facilitated diffusion. Remember this slide over here, facilitated diffusion, right here? Here's facilitated diffusion, glucose going from high to low. This little transporter has to be in the membrane, right? And in this case, for sure it is. Here it is right here. And then glucose now can go from high to low. What kind of process is that when glucose goes from high to low? Yeah, when anything goes from high to low, it is diffusion. And if a special membrane protein is required for that diffusion, we call it facilitated diffusion. So this is an important exam figure. Maybe you should just draw it out on a blank piece of paper. Okay, so this is how all the glucose is taken from filtrate in the kidney and put back in your body, as long as all of these cotransporters aren't saturated. Right? Somebody with diabetes mellitus, they get saturated because blood glucose is so high, it can't be transported back. Okay, so absorption. So this can happen in the digestive tract as well. Okay, small intestine or the kidney. So if it's a small intestine, we call that absorption. If it's from the filtrate in a kidney tubule back into the body, we call that reabsorption. Okay. Here is another form of active transport called bulk transport. What time is this class over? 45? Okay. Bulk transport. I see major changes in the cell membrane right here that is going to require ATP, right? And it's going to move these particles that are outside the cell into this vesicle, and they then become part of the inside of the cell. They move from outside to inside. And it requires energy. What you don't see on this illustration is that it is using up ATP. If you want to draw in ATP, that's fine. ATP going to ADP and inorganic phosphate. So this is active transport, right? The formation of this vesicle. When something moves from outside the cell to inside the cell via this vesicular transport, we call that endocytosis, right? Entering the cell via this vesicle formation is endocytosis. And probably you should know two forms of endocytosis. I think in anatomy we looked at it. If it's a large solute or a particle entering the cell, that would be like cell eating. And we call cell eating phagocytosis, right? If it is other kinds of solutes that are dissolved in solution and only a solution is allowed to enter the cell, we call that cell drinking or pinocytosis, right? So endocytosis has two forms, phagocytosis and pinocytosis. They're both active transport. The opposite can take place. Here we have material inside a vesicle. It can be moved over to the cell membrane. These membranes confuse because their essential fundamental nature is the same. They're both phospholipid bilayers. So everything inside this vesicle is then released to the outside of the cell. Generally, right, the name of that process when something's inside the cell, right, and moves to the outside via this vesicle is what we call exocytosis, right? Endo is inside, exo is leaving. And another way to think about this is that this is a secretory, part of a secretory pathway, right? So secretion and exocytosis are almost like the same kind of concept. This is how your cell would secrete something, like a hormone, for instance, or some other kind of material to the outside. And is bulk transport a form of passive or active transport? Active transport. Yep, it's active transport requiring ATP. All right, so who's got a question on transport? We looked at primary, looked at secondary. Yeah, question? Question. Hi. Okay, I tell you what, let me go to that slide. Tell me when I should stop. What slide do you like? This one right here? Okay, oh, this is a good one. Yeah, you should really have a nice appreciation of this. Okay, there are two forms of energy on this slide. There's one on the left, there's one on the right. One on the left, it requires ATP. The one on the right does not require ATP, but it requires some other kind of energy. All right, so there are two things happening on the slide, something on the left, something on the right. Let's look at the left-hand side first. And on the left-hand side, does it require ATP or not? Yeah. Okay. So it's active transport, and in particular, since ATP is there, it's primary active transport. And I really need to copy that little illustration with an ATP, like in the little sun right there. Okay. So how does sodium go from low concentration to high concentration? Low to high is active, right? And in this particular case, it's going to use ATP. So it's primary active transport. And we know a transporter, we know a pump in the cell membrane that does that. And that is the sodium-potassium pump. Remember, it's going to pump out two sodiums for every three potassium. No, it's going to pump out three sodiums and pump in two potassiums, right? And both are going to go against their concentration gradient. So this part of the slide here is primary active transport. So it's going to make a big gradient of sodium across the membrane. It's going to be high on the outside, low on the inside. It's going to require ATP to do that. And the mechanism or the machine that makes that happen is the sodium-potassium pump. All right, so now we have sodium on the outside of the cell or high concentration of sodium. What does it want to do? By diffusion to go back down, right? And if there's a special little machine inside the membrane, it will allow sodium to re-enter the cell. And when it does, there's another space for glucose to bind to that protein. Glucose then can go from low concentration to high. All right, so what do we call it when something goes from low concentration to high? That's active transport. And over here, I do not see any ATP being used. So this cannot be primary active transport. It is secondary active transport. But remember, active transport requires energy. What's the form of energy that's being used? The big gradient of sodium across the membrane. So whenever you separate things out across the membrane, that is a source of energy. Okay, that's basically how a battery works. And what's being separated in a battery is electrical charges. So there's membranes and batteries, a lot of positive on one side, a lot of negative on the other. Batteries contain energy because there is that gradient of electrical charge. Okay, so I don't know how well I did describing it, so ask me another question about this slide. I see two things, primary on the left, secondary on the right, and I really got to get a copy of what? I got to get a copy of this thing right here and put it over here on the left side because I only typed it in. Yeah. When you have a concentration gradient across a membrane, that is an energy source. Whenever you have something high on one side of the membrane, low on the other, that is a source of energy. And your body uses sodium a lot. Yeah.
Can you give us an example, practical example, of how this works in the body?
How this works in the body? Yeah. Right here. Okay. So here you have filtrate in a kidney tubule. Here you have blood. And so what is the job of the kidney? To take all of the glucose that's in filtrate and bring it into the body, right? And you're going to have almost zero glucose concentration, very low glucose concentration in filtrate, relatively high in the body, but still, because of these proteins, you can take all of the glucose out of filtrate and put it back into the blood as long as you have normal levels of blood glucose. If they're super high because you have diabetes mellitus, then all of these transporters get saturated, and then the rate of transport stays the same, and some glucose is left in the blood. Okay, so here is a really good example of the first part of this slide. Okay, this first part right here is sodium at a high concentration outside the cell. Because why? Here is the sodium-potassium pump, and on this illustration, this is really nice because what do I see? I see ATP. All right, so here is the primary active transporter. making sure sodium is high on the outside, low on the inside, and then that allows glucose to go from low to high, from outside to inside the cell. So all of these slides right here kind of are like nice steps to understand how something really happens inside your body. Okay, absorbing glucose from the digestive tract or resorbing glucose from filtrate and putting it back into the blood. Okay, who else has a question? Who's got a question? Yeah. ATP is used. Yeah, because all those microtubules have to be activated, and there's special kinds of little motor proteins on those microtubules and microfilaments that have to grab a vesicle and move it along, and that requires energy to do that. Yeah. So this is, bulk transport is primary, is active transport. Bulk transport is active transport. And probably I would like for you just to know that as bulk transport and not primary or secondary, right? That maybe not as appropriate to think of it in those terms. All right. Let's look at this once again. I think we looked at this. Here's that sodium-potassium pump, probably one of the most important proteins in your body. And when you take two potassiums and you move it inside the cell, or two positive charges and move it inside the cell, and then you take three positive charges from the inside, like sodium, and move it outside, what happens to the charge across this membrane? It becomes more negative on the inside. All right, so negative on the inside, positive on the outside, so there's a separation of charge, and your cell can use that as a form of energy, okay? Because you know opposite charges attract each other. All right, so that gets us to membrane potential. Potential means voltage, right? It can also be called membrane voltage because if you have opposite charges across a membrane, they want to move. They want to neutralize each other. That's like potential energy, right? Voltage is potential energy. So what devices do you own right now in your pocket that contain a voltage? Your cell phone hopefully has a nicely charged battery. So in one part of the battery, there's a bunch of positive charges, and in another part of the battery, a bunch of negative charges, and they can equalize each other if the terminals of that battery are connected together, right? And then when you connect those terminals together, they can perform work, like make a phone call. How many terminals does a battery have? It has two, right? One is positive and one is negative, and when you allow those charges or electrons in this particular case to move across, they can do work. Okay, and cells will do the exact same thing. All right, so how does this membrane potential develop? Look what I have right here. I have a phospholipid bilayer in a circle. What should you consider this thing? Yeah, I just see a nice phospholipid bilayer, so I could imagine this to be a cell. Right, not a very complicated cell because I don't see any proteins in here. All right, and we're only going to be interested in potassium. And I think I want to draw something on the board. To see how this develops. So let's not pay attention to the slide right now, but let's draw a cell. So here's a cell. And there's a solute particle that we call potassium, right? And it doesn't really matter. Yeah, I'll put a positive charge right there. Okay, and potassium can move across the membrane, no problem. And so we have high concentration of potassium on the outside, none on the inside. What does potassium want to do? Yeah, and if the membrane is permeable to potassium, potassium will enter the cell. Does everybody kind of see that? Okay, and after a long period of time, how much potassium is going to be on the inside of the cell compared to the outside? They should be exactly the same, equal to each other, right? And when they become equal, diffusion stops, right? So diffusion in this case is going to operate. Potassium is going to enter the cell. When the gradient is the same, diffusion is going to stop. All right, so how many potassiums are we going to have inside the cell? The same as outside. What's the charge across the membrane if potassium is the same? It's going to be zero, right? Because you have the same number of positive charges compared to inside and outside. All right, so the concentrations are equal in this particular case. Let's draw another kind of cell. Here's another cell, and this cell is permeable to potassium, but cells, when they're alive, produce really big proteins, really huge proteins. And can this protein, this is all one protein, right? Can this protein get across the membrane? It can't, it's too big. And it just so happens that this protein has a lot of negative charges on it. So there's a lot of negative charges that are stuck inside the cell. Let's compare it to this one here. So here we have potassium that is high outside the cell. It can diffuse in. How much is going to diffuse in? The same amount as in this particular case, right? The concentrations will be the same, but now we have these negative charges. What are these negative charges going to do to potassium on the outside? It's going to pull more potassium to the inside of the cell. So now you have more potassium, right, inside the cell compared to the outside because of these negative charges pulling potassium in. So now you have high potassium inside, low outside. Right? Which way is potassium going to want to go? By concentration. Just let's think about concentration. It's going to want to go from high to low. Right? So here is a force trying to get potassium to leave the cell. This is the concentration gradient. Okay. But how did more potassium enter the cell from the outside in this particular case? Because of the electrical attraction. You see that electrical attraction? And so which way does this electrical attraction work? Does it force potassium out or bring potassium in? It brings potassium in, right, because opposite charges attract. All right, so we got potassium entering like this. This is due to charge, right, electrical charge. Potassium is going to stop moving across the membrane when these two forces are equal to each other. All right, so do you see concentration is forcing potassium out, but the charge is bringing potassium in? All right, so there's going to be a point in time when there's so much potassium on the inside that these two forces are exactly equal. When potassium gets to be so high on the inside, potassium is going to leave, even though there's some electrical charge on the inside pulling it in. So that's going to be a new equilibrium. In this first case, at equilibrium, what's the concentration difference? None. With this kind of equilibrium, okay, where do we have high potassium? Inside the cell, okay, but what is driving, what's pulling potassium in? Electrical charge. But as the concentration inside the cell gets so high, what's going to drive it out? The concentration gradient, right? Things are going to stop when the concentration, the force from the concentration gradient is equal to the force generated by this electrical charge. Then there's not going to be any net motion. All right, so here is something else. So here we have a bunch of potassiums. There can never be enough potassium entering the cell, right, to neutralize all of these electrical charges. Because when potassium builds up to a high enough concentration, what happens? Some can escape, some can diffuse. Right? So the cell can never become exactly neutral in terms of its electrical properties. You can't get enough potassium to neutralize all of these negative, and what about these negative charges? Can they go anywhere? They're trapped inside the cell. All right, so at equilibrium, now the inside of the cell becomes negative and the outside is going to be opposite or positive due to this protein that's trapped inside the cell. And what else about potassium? Potassium is going to be high inside compared to outside because these negative charges are going to suck some more in compared to this case right here. All right. I don't know. How did I do? Can you see that this is going to be negative on the inside compared to the outside and more potassium on the inside compared to this case right here because your nucleus puts a lot of these negatively charged proteins into solution. All right, so look at that. That's going to be the basis for how we look at a lot of other things in this particular chapter. Sign-in sheet is going around, so please make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, and see you on Thursday. Yeah, it's probably going to come down.